Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Martin Pierce. Policy Forum Pod is, of course, brought to you by Crawford School of Public Policy, the Asia Pacific region's leading graduate policy school. And if you want to reach new heights in your policymaking career and study alongside some brilliant minds from all around the world, you should definitely consider joining us. You can find out more about our fantastic range of degrees and short courses at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. And I've got one of those brilliant minds right here with me in the studio. It's my co-host, Sue Regan. Hello, Sue. How are you?
Hello, Martin. I'm well, thank you.
Sue is, of course, a PhD scholar here at Crawford School. Now, Sue, we always like to start these podcasts by looking back over the week just gone. So what's caught your eye in the sort of wide world of public policy over the last week?
So last week we heard Morrison and the Australian government announce a $3.8 billion infrastructure stimulus, which everyone's excited about, you know, those of us who are interested in the economy.
It's an early Christmas present.
It is an early Christmas present, you know, and the idea is that it will also help speed up projects. So we'll hope to see some of this money materialise soon. But this week, the Business Council of Australia told the government that they should select 10 regional towns to power the economy outside of Sydney and Melbourne. And these towns should get special status for investment. And they were talking about, you know, Geelong, Ballarat, Newcastle and others. And I thought this was just an interesting development. You know, Jennifer Westacott talked about how we should be focusing on places and not projects. And yeah, it's relevant to what we're going to be talking about today with Helen Sullivan.
That would be quite a shift in focus, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it suggests picking winners for, you know, for towns to have this special status, which is very kind of controversial in some ways, that we can, you know, that governments can pick winners and not leave it to the market. So, yeah, so it's, I think, an interesting development.
How was this idea received, do you think, by government?
Yeah, we've not heard much in terms of a government response yet. But, you know, the Business Council of Australia generally have the ear of government. So I think somewhere it will be being listened to.
Great news if you're in Geelong or Newcastle then.
Indeed. Although they've not, you know, the Business Council just gave some examples. It's kind of, you know, down to government who would, they would do the selecting.
Okay, so before we get into this week's podcast, I just want to remind you to have a look at our brand new design of Policy Forum Pod's website, policyforum.net. Last week, we celebrated our fifth anniversary. We launched our all-new Policy Futures in Focus section on the site. And on that section, we've invited some authors who've previously written for Policy Forum to look at what lies ahead in their specific area of public policy and what policymakers should be focusing on in the coming years. There's heaps of great content on there for you to feast your eyes on. So go check it out if you haven't done so already. It's policyforum.net. Now, today on the podcast, we're going to pick up on some things that Sue has just been talking about. We're going to have a look at revitalizing urban centers. Despite the fact that more and more people are moving to cities globally, some places are increasingly struggling with slower population growth, lower incomes, and higher unemployment rates than others. A dramatic example of this development is, of course, Detroit in the United States, which has seen a catastrophic population loss over the past 70 years, from a peak of over 1.8 million in the 1950s to around 670,000 in 2019. In Australia, an example, albeit a less dramatic one for urban decline, is Dandenong, a diverse multicultural suburb of Melbourne that has been facing urban decline due to a number of social and economic challenges, such as an uncompetitive retail sector and an aging housing infrastructure. So today we want to ask, how can policymakers help revitalise urban centres that are currently declining? And what lessons can we learn from Dandenong in particular? And we have a very special guest to take on this. Very interesting question, haven't we, Sue?
We do indeed. Today our guest is Professor Helen Sullivan. She's the director here at the Crawford School of Public Policy, well known to us all. She's also the newly appointed president of the Asia and the Pacific Policy Society. She is also a fellow of the Higher Education Academy in the UK and of the Institute of Public Administration here in Australia.
This promises to be a really interesting discussion, so I'm really looking forward to it. How about we just get into it?
Welcome, Helen. It's great to have you back on the podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Sue.
Despite an ever-growing number of rural to urban migrants, some urban places are struggling with urban decline. You know, these areas are disadvantaged in a number of ways. The low population growth, you know, the most famous example that comes to my mind is Detroit in the US, which has undergone dramatic decline over recent decades. How does this kind of urban decline come about?
Well, it comes about through a range of reasons and, you know, principally their economic reasons. And certainly the case that that we worked in central Dandenong in Melbourne, that is both a reason why migration happened to that area. There was employment. It was a very strong area for automotive manufacturing, and that was one of a number of reasons why it was attractive to migrants. Not the only one, but an important pull. But of course, when the economic circumstances change, that changes the attractiveness of the area. And so what you see in places like Detroit, which are of course extreme cases, are the complete collapse of the economy. But also linked to that, the inability of the government in whatever form, local, state, to be able to act and intervene powerfully to address some of that decline. And I think certainly there are extreme cases. Detroit is probably one of the most significant, where you see that combination of economic decline with either the lack of competence or capacity of the state or the lack of preparedness of the state to intervene.
And how much does austerity have a role to play here? I know your work has kind of taken this really interesting angle of looking at how austerity policies might affect urban decline.
That's a really great question. I mean, the project that this case study is part of, the study of central Dandenong in Melbourne, is an international study that was funded by the Economic and Social Science Research Council in the UK. And it came out of a strong concern that there was in the UK following the global financial crisis to really examine what the impacts and the consequences of austerity were. And we were fortunate enough to be part of an international team led by Professor Jonathan Davis at De Montfort University in Leicester, looking at the different experiences of austerity across the world. And so there are 8 case studies. And you may wonder, I mean, listeners who are familiar with Melbourne and indeed Australia may think, hang on, austerity didn't happen in Australia in the same way that the global financial crisis didn't happen in Australia. And that's quite correct. And one of the reasons for picking an Australian case, and indeed this Australian case, was partly because it was an outlier. It was an example of somewhere where the pressures, while felt, were not experienced in the same way as they were in Athens, for example, or Baltimore, which were two of our other case studies. But nonetheless, what we found was the narrative of austerity played very powerfully. And certainly when we started doing this case study in 2013-14, the field work, that was the time of Tony Abbott's first budget, and with Joe Hockey, which was very much described as by critical commentators as an austerity budget. And so one of the things that happened was that there was an environment created in Australia of fiscal, what we've called fiscal conservatism, which is not new. I mean, that's a feature of Australian politics and economic management for some time, but was certainly something that became much more present and certainly shaped how people were thinking about decisions about resource allocation and how best to use limited resources.
I want to hear more about Dandenong. You know, this is a suburb which I think is about 30 kilometres southeast of Melbourne. It's been declining over the past 20 years or so. And you've used this suburb, as you said, in your recent research. And what did cause the urban decline in Dandenong?
Well, principally, it was economic decline. It was the fact that the principal economic base for the prosperity in the area, and Dandenong has been described and indeed has aspirations to return to being, you know, a key city in the state of Victoria, and indeed in the state of the area of Greater Melbourne. So it's while people think about Melbourne very often as the bit in the central business district, you know, the most livable city, well, until recently, there's much more to Melbourne than that, and part of Melbourne's prosperity is reliant on these outer areas, which are significant in terms of population, but also significant in terms of economic activity. And because of the certainly the role of the automotive and related engineering industries that had set up there, it was a very strong magnet for people, including migrants. And, you know, migration to Dandenong is not a new feature. This is something that has been happening over generations. It's just the nature of the migration has changed. But it's always been known as a place that is welcoming to migrant communities. And that has not changed, we found, even though the circumstances, the economic circumstances had changed. And that was one of the reasons why there was this very significant investment made in the area, which began in terms of planning in the late 1990s, but certainly started in earnest in 2005 with a huge injection of funding from the Victorian government to really try and develop a new approach to revitalising an area that was in serious risk of decline, both in terms of employment, but also educational levels of attainment were falling. And people were, as people do when areas become unattractive, you know, people were thinking about leaving and moving to other areas. So it was seriously at risk of what you might call sort of irreversible decline. And the state government took the view that in order to respond to that, it had to act in a way that it's rarely acted in terms of the amount of resource that was put into the area.
And has it been successful? Has there been a revitalization of Dandenong?
Well, we say yes. And we're very well aware that there are other colleagues who have done work in this area who disagree with us and take a very different view. Our assessment, though, is both based on the evidence of what's possible, as opposed to perhaps what might be desirable. But also there is evidence to suggest, and again, this is not particular to central Dandenong or even Australia. There is evidence to suggest, both from the UK and other places, that in circumstances of severe decline, what is required is a very significant response. And that means that governments, and it invariably is governments, have to find significant resources over and above what you often find associated with revitalization programs and urban regeneration programs, which tend to be things which, though significant, are really doing work around the edges. This was much more an attempt to really get at, okay, if we understand that there is major decline here, then what we need to address is, you know, transport, basic infrastructure, and the recreation of an environment that is attractive for the private sector to come in and invest. And that's where I think there has been the program's been less successful than people would have wanted. And certainly when we were feeding back this work to all of the stakeholders at different levels, that was one of the things that they very clearly pointed out, that while there's been a great deal of collaboration across sectors, including the private sector, the major sort of private sector investment that it was hoped this public sector led revitalization would produce has not yet happened. And so from that point of view, I think there is general agreement that the program has not achieved quite what it set out to. But, you know, it's not over yet. These things are very long term. And it's certainly the case that at the moment, the area is again experiencing the prospect of further decline because, you know, traditional industries are still diminishing. And so what the gap, if you like, is will there be a replacement industry or industries that can come in and provide the kind of economic base that engineering used to for that area? The state can do a lot and has done a lot, but of course can only do so much.
What do you think the takeaways are for policymakers on this project to revitalize Dandalong?
Well, I think you know we make a number of key points, and I think there are the things for us are both about revitalization in general, but also revitalization in an area that is so diverse. And that one of the most powerful findings for us was the ways in which cultural pluralism is so important, both as an ingredient for revitalization, but also as a way, if you like, of fulfilling the promise that Australia so often makes about being a tolerant and welcoming and diverse society. I mean, it is one of those cities, we would argue, where multiculturalism can work. But to do that requires an awful lot of effort and resource. And that work is ongoing. It's not work that you can do once and then forget about it. It's work that, as is in the way with all societies, you know, it's work that continues to need to be done. So for us, there's an important issue there, which we can come back to, if you like, about cultural pluralism. But in terms of, you know, what are the lessons for policymakers more generally? We would argue they're not anything new, but, you know, they are lessons that, you know, policymakers keep needing to hear. And some of that's about, you know, the things I've already mentioned, having an active commitment by the government at all levels to address this. You know, governments and states that step back and expect the private sector to fill the gap, you know, that doesn't happen. It may well be that what people wish to happen, but that doesn't happen. And certainly, what was significant here was both the level of resource that was put in, but more importantly, the fact that this was about a collaboration between all levels of government, and that rarely happens successfully. There was a huge effort on the part of both the local and the state governments to make this relationship work and to focus on redistributing resources in the right way. And that meant for the local government, the giving up of some powers, you know, and local government, as you know, in Australia has very few powers. So giving up some planning power to the state was actually quite a significant thing to do. The chief executive of the local council does not regret that and sees what's happened as being an absolute vindication of that decision, because what happened as a result was that there was genuine collaborative planning. Now, it didn't always work. There were, you know, obviously things go wrong. But overall, they felt that the benefits they gained in terms of, you know, getting the planning process that was rather more efficient than it might otherwise have been, was certainly worthwhile. So there's something there about, you know, government commitment across the levels, and that that meaning people have to trust each other and to compromise, and both of those things are often in short supply.
What was the investment in? Was it housing led?
That's a really great point. So the investment was principally in physical infrastructure,
right.
But oddly, thinking about it now, and this isn't unusual in major revitalization schemes, oddly, not housing was not a priority. So it was transport. It was the creation of parcels of land that were then appropriate for development. So there's an awful lot of work that goes into, you know, the identification of land, the parceling it up in particular ways that makes it attractive and appealing for a particular kinds of economic activity or other activity. So it was a lot of work that you probably, I mean, the transport you would see certainly because of the changes to the railway network and you know the new station and all of that, but a lot of the work you wouldn't see until something was built on it. So there's an awful lot of preparatory work that has to be done that requires a lot of resource, that where the benefits are not seen for some time, and that can of course mean that citizens quite rightly can get very frustrated with, well, you know, where's all this money gone and what's happening. But so the emphasis was both on physical infrastructure in terms of preparing land for development, but also there was significant development in public works. So there is a remarkable set of public spaces now in central Dandenong, some of which existed before, but some and have been revitalized themselves. I mean, the Drum Theatre is probably a great example of that. But there's also an extraordinary public library, and anybody who is the slightest bit skeptical about the value of public libraries in the 21st century only needs to go there to see what libraries do and the role that they play as meeting places and places where you can learn. I mean, the borrowing of books is a sort of subsidiary activity, yeah. But the role that that those places play as meeting places and as safe spaces for people, I think is something that is probably accepted more in Australia and in the United States than perhaps it is in other places. And certainly, again, I'm thinking here of the UK, where the public library system has been completely destroyed. But the power of the state to enable the creation of those spaces that are then made available to people to use for whatever purpose. That's been really, really important. So it's both about the building of things, but it's also about the creation of space.
Yeah.
Housing was something that was probably not thought about sufficiently, and that's been something that has been addressed more recently, because quite clearly, if one is wanting to maintain a diverse population and a sort of thriving community, you need to have a diversity of housing options, and that's been something that's been attended to perhaps later in the piece than you would have liked, but is happening now.
Can I take you back to cultural pluralism? You've said how you found it was a key ingredient in the revitalization, but what does that look like, and how do you bring it about?
Well, what it looks like is, firstly, you need political support for it, and that needs to be bipartisan. So you have to have an acceptance that this is not something that will change as the political winds change. And that's not so much an issue locally, but certainly, you know, whenever the state government changes, there is always concern that there will be a different approach to multiculturalism or cultural pluralism or whatever the language is that's used. So having that ongoing bipartisan support, even though it may change its emphasis, is really important. But what we've just been talking about, housing and housing diversity, is a really important element to this. So what we're talking about when we're talking about cultural pluralism is often it's about thinking through the basic things, but thinking about them in a slightly different way. So if you're thinking about the value of a diverse community, then what kind of housing stock do you need, and how do you set about designing and building that in a way that it remains affordable and accessible? Currently, Dandenong is experiencing a level of gentrification, which is putting pressure on that housing and is meaning that that people who otherwise would have been able to afford to live there are now finding themselves squeezed out. And that is unfortunate. But in general, levels of rental affordability remain at levels that are much less than elsewhere in certainly Melbourne, Greater Melbourne. So that's a really important element. And really thinking about how the extra things, because when people think about cultural pluralism, they often think about a completely separate set of activities. Now, that's important. And certainly the funding of things like the Interfaith Network, focusing attention on particular issues, and whether it's about access to women to particular services, whether it's thinking about...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I mean, a great deal has been made of the role of food as both a cultural and social unifier in the area, but also a massive opportunity for economic development. So there are now tours to central Dandenong from elsewhere in Melbourne for people to experience, you know, the markets and the diversity of food. And you can be very cynical about that, but practically it brings in important economic revenue, but it is also a way of introducing people to a variety of experiences they wouldn't otherwise have. But also importantly for the communities that live in central Dandenong, it provides an opportunity for making a living, but it also provides an opportunity for that coming together. But that needs to be actively supported. And so there's a great deal of time and effort and money put into both relationship building through things like the Interfaith Network, but also thinking through how do we design aged care services that are appropriate for the population that we have, as opposed to appropriate for a sort of one size fits all population. So it's really considering both the mainstream, if you like, public services and how they're designed in a way that's more appropriate, but also then thinking about, well, what else do we need to do? Mm-hmm. Now, we're not saying, and I'm sure there'll be lots of people, including some of my very dear colleagues, who will be screaming at the radio saying, no, this is all wrong. We're not saying that the things are perfect at all. There are significant problems still of unemployment in the area. There are significant problems in terms of racism and barriers to employment for particular groups. And there are ongoing problems, particularly around things like family violence. But again, they're not particular to that area, but they are manifest in a particular way. And so we're certainly not saying everything is perfect, but what we are saying is that thinking about cultural pluralism as a key ingredient in revitalization means that your revitalization isn't likely to be much more effective, and you can achieve some of the objectives we say as a society we want to achieve around multiculturalism.
A report by the Victorian Auditor General concluded recently that despite some progress, there's a distinct lack of sufficiently clear, agreed and monitored performance standards. What are your thoughts on that? And how can we, as policymakers, help ensure that some of the short-term successes that there have been turn into longer-term positive outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to have auditors generals to remind you of, you know, the need for performance and evidence and indicators. And that's certainly been one of the things that has fallen away from this project, which was monitored and evaluated, certainly, because, I mean, you're talking about huge amounts of money. So apart from anything else, you know, there was a need to account for that. That ceased a while ago. And you know, as we know, when you're working in constrained circumstances, then, you know, one of the first things to go is the evaluation of projects, because that's seen as something that, you know, well, we can do without. as an academic, I would always say it's really important to, you know, to know that you have an evidence base that is supportive of what you're doing or is identifying the gaps that you need to fill. So absolutely, I would agree that there's a lack of evidence and a lack of focus on performance. I think sometimes auditor generals focus on a very narrow range of indicators, and there are other ways of exploring what success looks like. But yes, nonetheless, important to have evidence. When you're talking about urban revitalization, you're never talking about the short term. You're always talking about the long term. And we know from repeated experiments all over the world that, these kind of 5-year, 10-year programs, they can make an impact. But often, if they're not sustained over time, it's almost as if they were never there when you go back 5-10 years later. And so, yes, there are short-term benefits and they're important. I think we would say in Dandenong that the commitment is there over the longer term, the partnerships, the relationships, which are so important. I mean, you know, one of the things, again, it's no surprise to anybody who's worked in this field for a long time, but, you know, what makes these things work is the interpersonal relationships, the fact that people are prepared to invest time and effort in building relationships, in building trust, in developing capabilities, in being able to see the world from other people's points of view, in developing the capacity to listen. These are all things which are bracketed off as soft skills, which is a phrase that I absolutely hate, because they're incredibly difficult things to do. You know, we assume somehow that we can just all do them. Well, if we could all do them and we could all practice them, we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in. They are very, very difficult things to do, and they require a huge amount of effort. And one of the things that has been very impressive to me is the extent to which that's been recognized, certainly at the local level in Dandenong, and is supported. You know, people are encouraged to think about the value of these skills and encouraged to develop those skills, as well as the development skills and the project management skills and all the other things that we know are important. Now, how you measure those things, of course, is incredibly difficult. And I don't think any Auditor General's report is ever going to be able to measure that. But you see it in the experience of being in that environment. And one of the measures, I think, is, for example, you know, who wants to work in local government in that area, and the diversity of employment patterns in local government. That I think tells you a lot about the power of these skills and capacities to both regenerate the area, but also to change the way in which we think about how public services work.
So it seems that collaboration between different levels of government and between other actors involved in revitalization were very important. What about engagement with the local communities? Was that done well in Dandenong?
Again, you get varying reports. For us, it's absolutely essential, and certainly for people in local government, there was never any question that this was something that was going to be done without public engagement, public support, public involvement, and all of the major projects certainly are evidence of, you know, they either emerged from demands by the community to that these things should be developed, or emerged as a result of, you know, extensive consultation the market was a great example of, you know, where, you know, the Dandenong market was something that was seen to be, you know, incredibly important symbolically, but also economically and socially, but also in decline. So how do you go about regenerating that in a way that means that it is both going to be an important economic engine, but also something that is socially and culturally significant? So, you know, you couldn't have done that just by having a bunch of planners decide what it might look like. You know, it was essential that there was extensive community involvement. And I think that's evident in a range of projects, whether it's, you know, the Afghan Bazaar streetscape or what's called the Little India Precinct. You know, all of these things emerged from different groups, sometimes proactively seeking support, and in other and other occasions being involved in extensive consultation. Now, some of those processes didn't work as well as they could have. And, you know, these things are always problematic. Car parking is, you know, and again, it's always the small things, you know, decisions that were made about car parking, which have a massive impact on who can access what services, have been really problematic. And certainly when we went back and did some work there, that was one of the things that, you know, people were just so frustrated about. You know, why have we lost so much car parking? Why is it so expensive? So there are always things that, and it's usually the things that aren't glamorous that become problematic, but also very important things that probably aren't seen. So a lot of the funding that goes in to supporting English language teaching, to supporting the development of programs for women in terms of employment and education, things which, you know, not high profile, probably don't cost that much money, but are essential to, you know, to have, and not just to have for a short period of time, but to have for a, you know, an ongoing period, and for those things to be led and run by organizations that are appropriate to do that. And that again requires you to have really extensive networks into what is an incredibly diverse community, and you know, is becoming more diverse because migration is not stopping, and migrants come from different places, and so there's a constant need for both the government and non-governmental actors to be thinking all the time about how do you adapt to newer communities? How do you make this a place that continues to be welcoming? And that's one of the striking things about Dandenong, is this emphasis on we will continue to be welcoming, not, you know, this is who we are and we don't want anybody else. And that's been something that's been present, you know, for generations.
Unfortunately, we are rapidly running out of time, Helen. But, you know, I'm going to ask you a typically hard question at the end. What is the single most effective thing, do you think, policymakers can do to revitalize urban areas?
Nothing for the first year. I think one of the big mistakes that policymakers make is they have all of these ideas. You know, they're incredibly skilled. They've spent a long time learning their craft. They have an opportunity, so they want to do things. And of course, they're under pressure to do things for their ministers and so on. But doing nothing for a decent period of time and just listening and learning is much more effective in the longer term.
And one final question for you, Helen. As you know, we keep a list of podcasts that our listeners enjoy in our Facebook podcast group. And we'd, of course, like to add your suggestion. What is on your playlist at the moment?
The podcast I listen to probably most regularly, and indeed every day, I would say, I'll go back to it, is a podcast called The West Wing Weekly, which is, as it suggests, a podcast that follows each episode of The West Wing, and not only interrogates the episode in terms of the drama and the storylines and the characters, but actually delves into some of the policy questions that come up as part of the narrative of the West Wing, and you know, anybody who is a policy wonk like I am will know about the West Wing and will probably have watched the series. And certainly, if you can't get enough of the West Wing, I would heartily recommend this podcast.
Helen, thank you. That was such a fascinating insight into Dandenong and, you know, wider questions of urban revitalisation. You know, and I'd love to hear more about it. Thank you for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, and thanks once again, Helen Sullivan, for that really interesting discussion. Lots to unpick there, so.
Yes, I thought it was fascinating, you know, in particular, the role of cultural pluralism and this idea that that's so important in urban revitalization. But also all the, you know, all the other things that you need to get right when you're trying to revitalize these areas that have been in decline for a long time. Yeah, it was a really good discussion.
Listeners, we're keen to get your thoughts on what we've talked about today. You can reach out to us. We are on Facebook. That's the best way to do it. Just type in Policy Forum Pod in the search bar and join us there. You can also contact us on Twitter, where we're @ Policy Forum, or send us an email, podcast@policyforum.net. And if you've ever thought about getting engaged in urban revitalization through effective and targeted policy, you might want to consider doing a postgraduate degree with us here at Crawford School. Our Master of Public Policy offers a variety of specializations, and there is sure to be one that's going to fit your interests. Go check them out. crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Now, let's get on to some of the questions and comments that we've had via our website, Policy Forum, and via the podcast group over the last couple of weeks. I want to pick your brains on these, Sue. The first is on an article called A Great University is First Made by Its Students. It was, of course, by Professor Brian Schmidt, who is the Vice-Chancellor here at the Australian National University. And in it, he writes that universities uniquely are where research and teaching meet, and that we need to bring together teachers, researchers, learners, and leaders in a creative environment of knowledge generation and exchange. And we had a comment from Dale Bailey on Policy Forum, who wrote, "But what if a great researcher is not a great teacher? I had a few of those as an undergraduate." What do you make of that, Sue?
Yes, well, I mean, I agree with Dale. I think we've probably all had, an individual who may well be a great researcher, but is perhaps not a great teacher. But I do think we're making strides in helping teachers be better teachers here at the ANU. There's a lot of investment going into making sure that people can be researchers and great teachers. And, you know, and it's my own experience that to be a really great teacher, it helps to be able to draw on your own research. But a good comment from Dale.
But these are distinct skills that people need to learn, right?
They are. And we need to invest in people building up those skills. I think it would be good if there were opportunities for people to specialize more. But I think there's, you know, whatever system we have, we need to make sure that we are helping people be both great researchers and great teachers.
Well, thanks so much for the comment, Dale. Really appreciate that. The next I want to turn to is another article which we put on Policy Forum. We've talked about this a few times, actually. It was the Declaring a Water Emergency, which was written by Quentin Grafton and John Williams. And in the piece, Quentin and John look at Australia's current drought and why effective policy responses seem to be missing in action. They also call on government to declare a water emergency. And we had a comment on Policy Forum from Hemant, who wrote, and this is quite a long comment, so apologies, but bear with me, I think it's worth discussing. They wrote, "The politics of language around drought versus water crisis has a deep meaning. The key question then is when and whether the long-term and multifaceted phenomenon of drought is recognised and a more integrative solution is chosen over the piecemeal and reactive interventions. As a researcher on the science-policy interface, I think the research community also has a role beyond presenting facts and offering a critique of policy narratives. Policy action labs and incubation hubs could help better educate policymakers." What do you think of that, Sue?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea from Hemant. You know, and we're seeing policy action labs and other types of hubs emerging, particularly in universities around Australia. And they can help educate policymakers. I think we just have to also remember that there is a job of educating researchers and academics as well in terms of how they understand how policy making works, and helping them to engage in the policy process.
Now, in Hemant's comment there, they talk about being a researcher on the science policy interface and how the research community has this role to play beyond presenting facts and offering a critique of policy narratives. But that's particularly challenging, I would imagine, for scientists who are used to dealing in facts. Yes, they sometimes wade into sort of critiquing policy narratives. How realistic is this sort of suggestion that's being put forward by the by Hemant there?
I mean, you make a good point, Martin. It's not without its challenges, And I think there is a question about how much we should expect scientists to go beyond putting out what they find in their research. But I think what's being suggested is really a greater engagement with the policy process and recognizing that their research findings and the facts are not going into a kind of void. They're going into a highly contested political environment. And if you're not aware of that and can't engage in that, then, it's likely that your research will have less impact. So yes, it's challenging. And I know a lot of scientists who don't feel comfortable going beyond what their research findings are telling us. But yeah, I think we can still explore this kind of murky area where we have to present those facts and try and shape narratives around policy using those facts.
Great. Well, that's a terrific comment. Many thanks, Hemant, for that. And thanks for your thoughts as well there, Sue. And a big thanks to everyone who has commented. We love hearing your thoughts, your suggestions and your ideas. So please do keep sending them in. The best way to do that is on Facebook. We're a Policy Forum pod, but you can also reach us on Twitter, apps Policy Forum, or email us at podcast@policyforum.net. Now, before we finish with this episode, we of course want to welcome some of our new pod group members on Facebook. So a big hello to Victor Y, Anne McGavin, Kevin Dorr, Marilyn E. Richardson, Jane Hendry, Tras Alleman, Rayleigh O'Neill, and Renee Manning, all of whom have joined us over the last week. Apologies to any of you whose names I have mangled, but welcome to the group. And special thanks actually to Victor, Anne, and Kevin, who have given us some fantastic ideas for future episodes of Policy Forum Pod. They're definitely going to be added to our whiteboard list. So let me run some of these past you, Sue, and see what you think. Victor suggested we should do something on issues in the Asia-Pacific region, particularly Southeast Asia, and its impact on Australia's national security and its role in the region. Victor, you might also want to check out our sister podcast, which is the National Security Podcast, which covers a lot of these types of issues. Anne wrote, "It's all about politics at the moment for me, and making sure I know who's pulling the wool over the eyes type of thing, and unbiased commentary." And Kevin wrote, "Politics is so tribal now, with the consequence that changing and modernizing the economy is seen only being in the context of winners and losers. How do we move beyond that paradigm, and what can we as citizens do?" How would you like to respond to those three suggestions, Sue?
For me, I think there's a theme there, particularly from Anne and Kevin, around the role of politics in public policy, which is a big theme. But I think there's something there that we could really start to perhaps drill down more into, how politics shapes policymaking processes. What are the disadvantages of a very kind of overtly partisan politics? But also, I think there's interesting questions we might explore around the inevitable and the positive aspects of politics and the policy process.
I want to pick up on something that Kevin wrote there. He said that politics is so tribal now. We can certainly think of examples of that. I mean, the obvious one to me is Brexit, which has divided a country basically in two. But do you think it's more broadly true that politics is tribal and that we only see things in the context of winners and losers?
I don't know if it's more tribal than it used to be. I think it's, the nature of a lot of democratic political systems means that we have political parties that, contest elections. So it kind of there's a tribalism is almost going to be inevitable. But, I think there's also a much wider set of questions around politics, around how different interests have power, in our society and in our economy. So you know, I think we need to see it in that broader picture, and it might be interesting to both, you know, look at a future podcast about the tribal nature of politics today, but also in this, the wider political context.
I mean, I just wonder who those tribes are, because political parties themselves have suffered from declining membership over a really long time. So who are these, who are the tribes that are, that Kevin is referring to here, do you think?
Oh, you have a good point, because I mean, I went straight to parties, you know, and political parties, but I think you're right. The way that politics is done these days is much more complex, and we have, you know, he may be referring to tribes in civil society as well, you know, whether that's young people, you know, protesting on climate change or other tribes that exist and are very engaged in our political process. But yeah, good point, Martin.
Hey, go me. I made a good point. That's terrific. Well, thanks for that, Sue. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. I hope you liked it. If you did, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast from. And if you'd like to leave us a 5-star review, that would be lovely too. It would be a big help to us in getting the word out about the podcast. Today's episode has been written by Yulia Arendts, with executive production by me, Martin Pierce, and post-production by Branko Svetijevic. We'll be back next week with another episode of Policy Forum Pod. In fact, our last episode of Policy Forum Pod for the year. But until then, from me, Martin Beast, cheerio.
And from me, Sue Regan, cheerio.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.